the series The Greatest Story We Will Ever Tell. And I thought in order for us to tell that story effectively and well, that the story can never be told effectively and well unless we are people who appreciate and live under the lordship of Jesus Christ. You have to live under the lordship of Jesus Christ. And so with that in mind, then, I want to say that the lordship of God can never be practiced as a casual affair. I want to say that very clearly. The lordship of God can never be practiced as a casual affair. When we're talking about the lordship of God, it's something that's rather poignant, that you live under the rule of God. And I was going to play it earlier, and later on, I think at the end of the service, I'll play a cool song that speaks to that. So hopefully you will enjoy it. Now, to illustrate this, I'd like for you to turn, if you would, to 1 Samuel chapter 15. And I'm going to read selections from that. It's a long chapter. I don't want to read it all, but I want to read the most important parts. And so beginning with verse 1 of 1 Samuel chapter 15, if you would turn to that. And begin with verse 1. And Samuel said to Saul, "The Lord sent me to anoint you king over his people Israel. Now therefore listen to the words of the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I have noted what Amalek did to Israel in opposing them on the way when they came up out of Egypt. Now go and strike Amalek, and devote to destruction all that they have. Do not spare them, but kill both man, woman, child, infant, ox, sheep, camel, and donkey." Verse 7. And Saul defeated the Amalekites. So he went and he fought the Amalekites. And Saul defeated the Amalekites from Hevelah as far as Shur, which is east of Egypt. And he took Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive, and devoted to destruction all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep and of the oxen and of the fatted calves and the lambs and all that was good. It would not utterly destroy them. All that was despised and worthless, they devoted to destruction. The word of the Lord came to Samuel. I regret that I have made Saul king, for he has turned back from me, he has turned back from following me, and has not performed my commandments. And Samuel was angry, and he cried to the Lord all night. Verse 13. And Samuel came to Saul, and Saul said to him, "Blessed be to you, the Lord. I have performed the commandment of the Lord." And Samuel said, "What then is this bleating of the sheep in my ears, and the lowing of the oxen that I hear?" Saul said, "They have brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and of the oxen to sacrifice to the Lord your God, and the rest we have devoted to destruction." Then Samuel said to Saul, "Stop, I will tell you what the Lord said to me this night." And he said to him, "Speak." And Samuel said, "Though you are little in your own eyes, are you not the head of the tribes of Israel? The Lord anointed you king over Israel, and the Lord sent you on a mission and said, 'Go, devote to destruction.'" And by the way, that word destruction is the Hebrew word charim. Charim. They have a sort of a guttural pronunciation. It means literally destruction. It is part of what was called the ban, right? And is what we know in the Old Testament as the genocide in the Old Testament. The ban or the charim, which is the destruction of all things. "So the Lord sent you on a mission and said, 'Go, devote to destruction the sinners, the Amalekites and fight against them until they are consumed. Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you pounce on the spoil and do what was evil in the sight of the Lord? And Saul said to Samuel, I have obeyed the voice of the Lord. I have gone on the mission on which the Lord sent me. I have brought Agag, the king of Amalek, and I have devoted the Amalekites to destruction. But the people took the spoil, sheep and oxen, the best of the things devoted to destruction, to sacrifice to the Lord your God in Gilgal. And Samuel said, Has the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, it is to obey is better than sacrifice, and to listen than the fat of rams. For rebellion is as the sin of divination, and the presumption is as iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king. And so we're going to talk a little bit about Saul and how the particular way in which Saul did not observe the lordship of God and its impact upon him and upon Israel, and how Saul in many ways is not unlike we today, and how he exercised a casual relationship with God in terms of the lordship of God over all of his life. Now let's talk about Saul first. Saul was the first king of Israel. He was anointed by the last judge of Israel, Samuel. So you will recall that when Moses, who didn't quite enter into the land of Canaan, and Aaron, who did, along with the Israelites, they entered in and they divided up the land of Canaan into 14 tribes, 12 main tribes. Over a period of time, because they had no king, each region governed itself to a large degree. But during times of crisis, a charismatic leader would oftentimes rise up, and they were called judges. And so during times of natural crisis, the main perpetrators were the Philistines, the Amalekites, the Moabites, the Ammonites, and I'll show you where they were in a few minutes on a map. The people of Israel were tired of the judges, and they wanted a king like all the other nations had. And God saw that as a rejection of him, because Israel at the time was a theocracy. And so he saw that as a rejection of him, but he then appointed Saul. And so Samuel anointed him king over Israel, and Saul reigned for about 40 years. And so when he was rejected as king, maybe a better understanding of that would mean that while he reigned for 30 or 40 years, about 40 years, while he reigned for that long, what it ultimately meant was that his dynasty would end, that it would not carry on, that once Saul was done, he was done, and no family members would inherit the kingship of Israel. So Saul was between 30 and 40 years of age when he became king, and he reigned for about 40 years as king of Israel. He was a large man. Like all men of his time, he was in the local militia. So when you read in like 1 Samuel 14, you think his father sent him out to collect some donkeys that had gotten loose. And he spent days with a servant trying to track down these donkeys. And you think, what? Like, why would someone who's chasing donkeys be qualified to like rule over a nation, right? Well, he, like so many men of his time, were in the militia and probably distinguished themselves many times over in their fights against the Amalekites and the Philistines and people like that. So you have to understand in a broader context the kind of person that Saul would have been and what might have qualified him. He was the father-in-law to David, so his wife, I believe her name was Michelle, I'm not sure of the pronunciation, but he married a daughter of David. King David married a daughter of Saul. And interestingly enough, Saul was given this unique opportunity. And as this unique opportunity, God believed that Saul had what it took to do the job. He's not going to promote somebody and expect them to fail. He's not going to promote you to a job and expect you to fail. That job might be challenging. It might be difficult. You might have to deal with people, which would make it really difficult. All of those kinds of things, right? But it doesn't mean that just because it's challenging and difficult that you don't have the ability to do it. If God opens that door for you, then he believes that you have the ability to do the job. And if you don't do the job, it's a failing of yours. It is not a failing of his. He didn't tap the wrong person. We just didn't tap the right resources. Saul chose not to make the most of the opportunity that God had given him. So how about a little bit of historical background and context so you understand the specialness of this particular event? So this happened in the post-entry into the Promised Land. So the Israelites had been in there for a number of years. they were surrounded by their enemies. And they were surrounded by their enemies who had particular things about them that would have concerned God very much. And so the socio-political background and context was this. You'll see a map up on the screen. And, right there. And I tried to make it as big as I could. But if you look at the lower end there on the very bottom, if you have good eyesight, you can see where it says Edom. And then to the left of Edom is Amalek. And then sort of above Amalek, you'll see Philistia. Or the Philistines. Saul and Israel would have been in between all of them. Philistia, Amalek, Edom, Moab, Ammon. Israel at that time was in the middle of all of those nations. And they, particularly Philistia and Amalek and Ammon, constantly harassed Israel. So let's talk a little bit about the Amalekites because it lends a lot to this story. And you can see, hopefully you'll be able to see the enormity of the problem that Saul exercised by not observing the lordship of God. So the Amalekites, let's go back further in history to about 2000 BC. Which would be about 1,000 years before this. So Abraham and Sarah lived about 1,000 years before Saul lived. You remember that Abraham was to have a child with Sarah, the child of the promise, and that child's name was Jacob, that was later renamed Israel. And you remember that they grew to a ripe old age and still did not have the child of the promise, and so they began to lose faith and trust. There must have been a conversation between Sarah and Abraham where Sarah said, look, clearly God's not going to give us the child of the promise, and so why don't you take my handmaiden, Hagar, and have a child with her? And so Abraham did, and they had Esau, the father of Islam. Ishmael. I apologize. Thank you. So let me just think. Then I have to make another connection here. So Esau and Jacob would have been the two brothers who were born out of in that particular arrangement. And Esau was the child that was born first with the reddish hair, kind of a hairy child, and then Jacob. And from Esau came a person named Amalek further on down the line. But Amalek was a descendant of Esau who was outside of the promise, right? And Amalek became the father of the Amalekites. Now, another interesting part about the Amalekites, when Moses and Aaron were bringing the Israelites out of Egypt and they were wandering around in the wilderness, the first tribe that they encountered were the Amalekites. And the Amalekites attacked Israel in great numbers. And it was a fierce pitched battle that lasted the whole day. And they discovered that when Moses held up the staff, that Israel prevailed. And when Moses lowered the staff, the Amalekites prevailed. And so Moses held up the staff. And he grew tired, and people had to hold his arm up. This is in Exodus. And so people had to hold his arm up in order for Israel. In fact, the battle was so fierce as it was to go into the night, the scripture reads that the sun stood still during the day so that Israel would prevail over the Amalekites. So when we read here in chapter 15 about when God says to Samuel and to Saul, I remember what Amalek did when Israel came up out of Egypt. I want them to be punished for what it was that they did. And so that's kind of the connection and the lineage of the Amalekites. That's the first big encounter that they have. And so the Amalekites proved to be troublesome to Israel once they moved into Canaan. The Amalekites worshipped the same god that the Ammonites worshipped, the god called Molech. Molech was a demonic god. It was a satanic figure, the culmination of which was to sacrifice infant children to him on a regular basis. So when the Amalekites tried to subjugate Israel, what it would mean was two things. One, it would mean that if they could overwhelm Israel, Israel could no longer be the light to the nations that they were called to be through the law of God. Two, it also meant that they, in their subjugation, they would be forced, the people of God would be forced to worship a satanic figure. So when Solomon dithered about what he should do to the Amalekites, he put all that at risk. The people of God, risking them to no longer be a light, and risking who remained to be people who would be forced to worship a demonic god. Does this make sense to you? The Philistines then, and this is an add-on, but it's an important one, because Saul died at the hand of the Philistines. Well, he took his life, but he was about to die. David fought the Philistines on a regular basis, and so you had Israel wanting a king and God providing them a king to protect them from the Philistines and the Amalekites, so that they would not become the Philistines and the Amalekites, right? Now, the Philistines were a seafaring warrior nation all over the Mediterranean. They went as far as Tarshish or Spain. They were all over the place. But one of their headquarters was in Israel. So if you look at the Mediterranean Ocean, which is over here, in Israel, which is right here, they occupied that western seaboard along Canaan. And they were a regular source of frustration for Israel. And they were a warrior people. They were not unlike the Vikings 1,800 years later. So the Vikings, who terrorized and dominated northern Europe and the northern Atlantic Ocean and almost overwhelmed Great Britain, they were the Philistines were very similar to what they were in that way, and they occupied that whole area, and so they also worshipped a god named Marduk. Marduk was the oceanic form of Molech. So they were into infant sacrifice as well. Marduk was a demonic god. And the Israelites would have been forced to worship Marduk as well. And it was Saul's job to prevent the Philistines and the Amalekites from overwhelming Israel. And so the reason why God was so harsh on the Amalekites and the Philistines was because of, if you go back into Exodus again, you'll read where he tells Moses that I want you to enter into the land of Canaan because their sin has risen to the heavens and my punishment and discipline for them has ripened. And I want you to be my arm of punishment on those people for the evil that is in their land. And so I gave you some examples about the Philistines and the Amalekites in that regard. Casual, as evidenced by what he did with the Amalekites, because of how casual Saul was and not following God's express commands, he risked Israel in this way. So here's the thing, and this is a kind of an interesting example, I think. Had Saul continued to do what he did, had Israel succumbed to both the Philistines and the Amalekites, then what would have happened? In what way would the world have seen Israel as a light? And how horrible would it have been for the people of God to worship the children of Satan? I'll give you a more modern example of what Saul was supposed to do. About 1,800 years after Saul, in Great Britain, the Vikings overran most of Great Britain. And there was only one small province in the southwestern corner of Great Britain that remained intact under a guy named King Alfred the Great, who was a Christian king. And for decades, King Alfred the Great resisted the incursions of the Vikings and how the Vikings forced Christian Britons to worship their gods. And the only province that was successful in resisting them was the province of Wessex under King Alfred the Great. And he was so successful in his resistance that eventually he was able to assimilate the Vikings into the Christian faith and unify most of Great Britain. That's what Saul was supposed to do, but that's not what Saul was inclined to do, because he thought he had a better plan. It wasn't the plan of the Lordship. It wasn't following the Lordship of the Lord and his plan. It was following his own plan. So King Saul of Israel was surrounded by demon-worshipping nations, anointed to lead and to protect the people of Israel and their sovereignly ordained purpose. Now, there were three reasons why King Saul would have spared Agag. So when we read in there, you think, okay, he was supposed to kill everybody, including the king. You would think of all the people that should have been killed, it should have been the king, right? Of all the people, he'd kill the king. But there were three reasons why Saul did not kill the king. The first would be political influence. So if he keeps King Agag alive, then all of the connections that Agag has become his connections, conceivably. And he could use those for himself. Number two, of any person in the land of Amalek, I bet King Agag probably knew where all the stashes and the caches of extra gold and silver were. So with a little persuasion, he could have increased his wealth, conceivably, by what King Agag knew. But the other third reason is this, is that if he treated King Agag well, and the fortunes were reversed, then maybe other kings might treat Saul well. I don't know if you know that, but during many wars in colonial times, if someone of the aristocracy was captured in a battle, they were treated really well. I mean, the soldiers suffered, but they were treated really well. And so there was always this cordiality between the aristocracy. It's kind of like that. So Saul was collecting to himself advantages, trusting in him, not trusting in the Lord, not doing what the Lord wanted him to do. There were two reasons for sparing the sheep and the goats and the lambs and animals like that. Probably while they were exercising the harem, the destruction, the people were saying, "Hey, Saul, there is nothing wrong with these sheep and these cattle. They're perfectly fine. They're in great shape. Why can't we use them?" And Saul, wanting to be popular, backed down from what his people wanted. Plus, he was going to get cut, and he was going to increase his wealth as well. And so it has to do with the popularity of the people and further acquisition of wealth, none of which is trusting in the Lord in terms of how the Lord will provide for him, what the Lord will do for him. So the irony is that Saul and his people thought nothing about killing entire families, but found the mercy to spare King Agag and the sheep and oxen. It's kind of ironic, don't you think? That you could wipe out entire families and say you were doing the Lord's will, but you'd hang on to the sheep and the goats and the king. Clearly, he did not do what he was supposed to do. Saul's casual observance, Saul was very casual in his observance when it came to the lordship of God. Look, when you read the early life of Saul, and there's not a whole lot, Saul doesn't come off as a bad guy. I mean, he's a guy who's going after some donkeys. He's doing his father's will. He treats his servant well. He seems to have a good head about himself, a decent guy. You don't get the sense in which when he was anointed that he was arrogant or prideful about that. You don't get any of that. It's not like other kings like King Ahab or Queen Jezebel or some of the more horrific kings and queens of Israel that lived in stark rebellion and disobedience to God. This was not Saul. That's not the person that he was. So Saul was not a king who lived in wanton rebellion, but rather lived comfortably with an undisciplined and unrefined faith. You put that up there, Austin? Saul was not a king who lived in wanton rebellion, but rather lived comfortably with an undisciplined and unrefined. And this is the way in which many of us are like Saul. We have too much of a casual relationship with God. We are too undisciplined. We are too unrefined. We don't take the time to think more deeply, to study, to ask questions. And so we imitate Saul in many of these ways. We're not terrible people. Saul was not a terrible person. He became a little unglued later on when it was apparent that David was going to inherit his kingdom. But not initially. He was not that way. Saul was not unlike many Christians. He was negligent in the lack of precision and conviction to know what full obedience to God's lordship looks like. Is that something that drives us? Is that something that drives all of us here? That we want to know what full obedience looks like? Are we convicted in that way? Or are we comfortable with those gray areas of our lives? So, for example, I have kind of an illustration. It shows, if you can go to the slide that shows the white, yeah. Well, it should have, it came up a little bit differently here. It should be more black than what there is, but King Saul lived in the gray. I mean, broadly speaking, he knew what was good, and broadly speaking, he knew what was bad. But because of his unrefined, unconvicted life before God, there was a lot of gray. And because there was a lot of gray, he didn't exercise his rule in such a way that that would allow the lordship of God to direct him and to guide him. So if you have smaller bands of black and white, then that means you get to make more choices about how you live in the gray. You're more in control. You get to decide. What it really ought to be like is this. So we ought to know very clearly what is good and very clearly what is bad. And that whatever the gray is, we have to navigate that well. Let me ask you this question. If you are traveling someplace and you have to use landmarks, and there aren't as many landmarks as you would like to have to get to where you want to go, do you pay closer attention or do you pay less attention? If your directions are obscure and you are not sure and you only have a few indicators of what might be the right way to go, do you pay more attention or do you pay less attention? You pay more attention. And if we find ourselves, our lives, in an area of gray, should we pay more attention or less attention? More, because we're trying to find our way through in an area that has less landmarks. And so that means we have to think more. We have to pray more. We have to consider more. We have to receive more advice about what to do. That's how it is in the gray. And some parts of life are inevitably gray. In fact, I'll say this. There are some things that are gray. Gray for me, but they're black or white for you. And black and white for you, but gray for me. There are people in here who are predisposed to alcoholism. It's a black and white issue. You shouldn't drink. You risk becoming an alcoholic. There are some people who have no sign of that at all, and they can drink wine or whatever casually, and it has no impact upon them at all. They're disciplined with how they do it. It's gray. There's no biblical commandment not to drink. The biblical commandment is not to drink too much. But there's another biblical commandment that says, look, if you have a weakness, and you know you have a weakness, then you're obligated to be careful with how you manage that. So the more gray we find in our lives, the harder we must work to determine what obedience looks like and how to trust the lordship of God. Saul lived in the gray. He felt like he could make these decisions and these choices apart from God, that they were under his purview, that he could do that, and he could not. And in doing that, he risked Israel, the people of God, and their mission. And God wanted to make it very clear that that's not how he wanted his nation to be. So submitting to the lordship of God not only means obedience, but trust as well. I can be obedient, but still not trust. Right? I mean, if you're a parent, you can make your kids listen to you, but that doesn't mean that they trust your wisdom on what you want them to listen to you about. Isn't that true? If you're an employee and your employer says, this is what I want you to do, I don't care if you like it or not, you got to do it. But I think it's dumb. I don't trust it. I don't care if you think it's dumb or don't trust it. You're going to do it anyway. But that's not how God wants us to be. God wants us to obey and to lovingly trust as well. So the more gray in life, the more gray in life we are comfortable with, the more we exercise our lordship, our choices, our decisions. And we hear the voice of the serpent. Did God really say? I mean, isn't that what we do when we're in the gray? Well, let's see. I don't have any real clear direction here. I'm going to have to exercise some of my own choices. And when we do that, we find ourselves inevitably drawn to something that advantages us more and disadvantages us less. And the voice behind that is, did God really say? When we're looking at that landmark, are you sure? Is that really a landmark? Is that what we're really supposed to do? The truth of the matter is that God oftentimes takes us into the gray because he wants us to exercise the discipline that comes. He wants us to get practice with having to go to him, seeking counsel, praying more diligently, all of those kinds of things. The gray exists oftentimes for our edification, but we use it most of the time to our advantage. The gray exists most of the time for our edification, but we use it most of the time to our advantage, as Saul did. And that's why he lost his kingship and his dynasty. Because the higher up you go, the more and the higher the expectations that God has for you, and the less room you have for failure.